It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 219, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, travel tech, moon photos, computer reformatting, and an AI reading experiment.
And we're back. So last week was kind of a scheduled interruption, unlike the month prior. And apparently, Gary, you've been traveling. What's been going on?
Yeah. I went to London for about a week and a half, just for fun. Mm-hmm. And whenever you and I travel, we run into tech things to talk about.
Yes.
Probably pretty typical. I was really excited because I knew about the tech thing I wanted to talk about in advance.
Okay.
And it did not disappoint. So for a while now, the London Underground has had, you know, a system where you can use NFC with your phone and such to travel. So the idea is when you get on a subway system, it's every city's different, right? There's some sort of card with a funny name you got to get. And you got to charge it up. You know, it's called this in one place, this in another place. And the way you use it's different in every place like that. And it's one of those pains when you travel, it's figuring out how, as a traveler, I can use the system. Because usually they have some completely different way for residents to use it, right? Regular commuters, and they sign up and all that. And you can't do that at all. You have to be a local to do it.
Yep.
And to be a visitor, you know, sometimes there's like a day pass or something that's a little more expensive that nobody local would ever use, but it's perfect for the visitor. Well, I've been to London before, and, you know, I know that their funny little name for their card is the Oyster card. And then in the past, it's always been a pain to be like, okay, I'm a visitor. I don't even live in this country. How do I get one of these cards so I can travel on the subway system without much hassle? Because it's already enough of a hassle to not know the city and to not know how the system works. You just want it to be easy. And I was researching that yet again. And I was like, oh, yeah, Oyster card. I kind of remember that. And then I kept running into contactless payments. There's an option, contactless payments. I'm like, well, that's, you know, okay, great. They have a system for that. It doesn't help me. It looks like I have to get an Oyster card. And then I saw some offhand comment somewhere that suggested that I very much could use the contactless payments thing because all that meant was just using your iPhone to pay for it, like Apple Pay or, you know, Google Pay or Samsung Pay or whatever it is you want. You just use that instead, just like you would in a shop.
Interesting.
And it was interesting that they kept calling it contactless payments, and it was everywhere, but it was never explained to the point where I was like, oh, as a visitor, this is what you want to use. And it solves all your problems. So after reading about it, it seemed like I could just use this. Like, I don't have to sign up for anything. I don't have to get an Oyster card. I don't have to do anything in advance. And I discovered something interesting about, at least on the Apple devices, on the iPhone and the Apple Watch, there's a setting for this. And I remembered hearing about this when they, you know, first brought it up a couple years ago. But I just dismissed it because there was no way for me to test it. And it's the Express Transit setting. Because the idea is when you use contactless payments, say you use Apple Pay on your iPhone, you go up to a cash register and you're going to buy something. And they say, you know, well, how do you want, you know, cash or credit or whatever? And you're like, oh, I'm going to use my phone. And they're like, okay. And you see the symbol and you move your phone over to it. And then it asks for confirmation, you know, double click the side button, Face ID, Touch ID to confirm it's you and all that. And you can't really do that very well on a transit system because you're in a long line of people. There's people that need to get on the train that are behind you.
Right.
You can't go and authenticate and do all that just to get through the turnstile. So this express transit mode, which is just a on-off switch, you turn that on. And if you're using your iPhone at a place like the London Underground, then this will not require authentication. So the idea is it's cheap anyway. You're talking about a few dollars or pounds, right?
Sure.
So it's not like somebody could buy a TV with it, right? It's like just a few dollars or pounds. You're also getting onto a system that's heavily monitored, right?
Right.
So it's
right.
probably not a good thing to try to like steal somebody's phone and try to use it to save a few pounds. And it's not going to bother you with authentication. It's just going to happen instantly. Plus, it will work with the transit system because in this case, you're being charged based on where you get on, where you get off.
Right.
And the NFC is like, great, I got it. So I used it to get on and it just, you know, just does a little vibration on the phone and it, you know, I forget what even the screen says or whatever, if you look at it, and it's just you're on. You just swipe it, really, and you're on, and it's not going to bother with any kind of authentication. You can go through the turnstile as fast as anybody else, pretty much instantly. And then when you get off, you do it again, and it says, oh, okay, journey complete, point A to point B, and it figures it out, even to the point of if you take multiple trips during the day. And this isn't a thing the phone does, but I think a thing the London Underground system does. You know, if you take multiple trips, it's going to kind of calculate things, and there's a kind of a maximum fare you get to, I think. So you don't have
Oh,
to worry
right.
about like, oh, I'm going to be going back and forth all day on this. Is there like a day pass? No, just use it. And when you get to the day pass amount, you
We'll
know, that's
stop.
it. It's going to stop charging. And so it makes it effortless. I don't have to sign up for anything in advance. I didn't have to pay the 5 or 7 pounds for the card that you don't get back or anything. I just from the very first time I went to a station, I just swiped my phone and then I was in. And then when I got off, I swiped the phone going out and I was done. And then I only did that for the first time because it's supposed to work with the Apple Watch, and indeed it did. So from that point on, all of the other trips I took, I never even took my phone out of my pocket. I just used my watch. And I even had my, long sleeves on and stuff. I couldn't even see my watch. I just placed it over, and I would feel it pulse. And knowing, and of course, then the gates open. I feel it pulse, and the gates open, and I go right in as fast as can be, like a second. And it was great. It made it feel to me like it was just like free transit system. I mean, it wasn't. I was getting charged, but being on vacation, I wasn't worried about those amounts of money, right? You spend that amount of money to get over on an airline flight to London, you're not worried about £1.75 for a trip, right? That's nothing. So for me, it was like it just opened up everything. I didn't have to fuss with how much was still on my card, what did the app say, all do lose my card, all that stuff. And I even understand that because it uses NFC, it will even work when your battery is dead. So if your phone battery or watch battery dies while you're on the journey or before you get on the journey, there's always that little power reserve just for the NFC transactions. And that's enough. Like the system will handle it. It's not your watch or your phone that's actually doing all the calculating there. It's just indicating to the system that it's you. You just went through this gate, and it's you again. You just went through that gate.
Well, when you think
Anyway,
about it, so
great.
here's a question. So it's NFC, right? A lot of credit cards have NFC built in. There's no battery, there's no power. I mean, is it just the case where you can tap your credit card in the right place and have that work?
I didn't I when I read about it, it was all about using the phone and all that. I don't know if you could use a card. I looked at other people going through, and a lot of people with Oyster cards, with the standard one, and some other people using their phones, and I assume they were doing what I was doing. I didn't really notice anybody using I never saw anybody using a credit card or anything like that. But anyway, it was just great. I loved it, and made my trip that much better. It was just a cool use of the technology like Apple Pay that we've been talking about on the show for years.
It's funny. So, questions. Do you know if, as a person not using an Oyster card, are you paying a different rate?
I don't think so. I saw lots of stuff about like rates and everything like that, but the contactless payments was suggested as something having to do with like everyday people can use this. Like, it wasn't saying it was a special thing for vacationers or anything like that. So I'm thinking I was paying the same rates, but there are probably all sorts of other things going on. Maybe if I was a resident there, I would have an account I would log on to, and I would tie it to my contactless payments. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting though. It's funny because when I was in the Netherlands last year, I think we already talked about this once. The train system there works very much like what you described with the Oyster card, except there it's an OV chip card. And when I got off the airplane at the airport, I went over to the desk and bought one, right? Put some amount of money in it. Haven't used it all. It's whatever's left is still sitting there. But same thing, tap the card against the reader before you get on the train and then tap it when you get off. There, of course, it's countrywide. It's not just a city thing. And I was frustrated by some of that. I would have loved to see it migrate to what you've described. And if I understand correctly, they might be in the process of doing that. I was kind of expecting that you might end up having to install an Oyster Card app on your phone. But if you're just using Google Pay, Apple Pay, whatever, that's great. Because I actually, in fact, I think I still have the OV chip card thing on my phone. I'm checking right now. Even though I don't necessarily plan to go back there anytime soon. I may have removed. Oh, no, there it is. OV Pay. Sure enough. And it's nice for it to be completely decoupled from anything else. It's just another transaction. I love it.
Well, yeah, I was amazed that, I mean, I think the most amazing thing was, is I did no preparation at all, which is interesting.
Yes.
Because I went on, you know, 2 days before I traveled, I went on, you know, to find out how to, how do you do the London Underground nowadays? And like, I could have gotten some sort of special card, like an Oyster card sent to me if I had thought about that like a month earlier. And I could have put my address in the US and something would have been sent to me and, you know, the result.
But
I was like, I stopped reading there because I was like, no, I'm traveling in 2 days. That's obviously not. So there was all this prep work I could have done on the one hand. On the other hand, the option I went with was nothing at all. Like literally no app, didn't sign up for anything, didn't tell anybody I was coming. I just walked to the underground and put my phone up against the you know, the turnstile reader. Mm-hmm. And I was on. So that was just, it's just interesting that you could do that today.
Yeah, I love it.
And I think the buses work different. I never ended up taking a bus just because I'm a big fan of subways and the mm-hmm. underground is just fantastic in London because you can go so many places and I'm not afraid to walk a few blocks at either end. But as I understand it, if I had to take a bus, it works just like a traditional NFC transaction where it would ask for authentication and just pay for the bus ticket. And then it's because in a bus, you just go get off. You know, you don't go through a turnstile. You know?
Right.
So, and I did take a bus actually in I was spent a day in Cambridge, and I did actually ride a bus there actually twice. And that is how it worked there. And I assumed it's the same way it works in London, just a normal NFC thing. But it was neat not having to have cash or anything in advance for that.
It's funny because we've got roughly the same kind of a thing compared to the Oyster card. Here in the Seattle area, except of course here it's called an Orca card. The same thing though. It's the buses, it's the ferries, it's the light rail. You know, it's one card, but again, same thing. You got to top it up. You could set that up to happen automatically, so you don't have to think about it. You know, if it gets below this amount, then add that amount. You can set up those, but you have to set all that up beforehand, and it's some, you know, it's an additional card you have to carry. So yeah, interesting. I love when they try to make things as seamless as possible. It seems like most cities are motivated to get more people to take public transit, and anything that they can do to make the process as painless as possible is, in my mind, a really, really good thing. And clearly, that's exactly what they've done.
Yes, and I think London's a good place to, you know, be on the forefront of that, because getting around on surface streets in cars is definitely slower.
Right.
Yeah. It's like there's no doubt about it, because I took a car. We kind of regretted not taking, because you could take the underground all the way from Heathrow into town, but you've got your suitcases with you. And we were there for like a week and a half and everything like that. So it's like, then you know, you're taking your suitcases on the underground, you're jet lagged. It's a whole, you know, it's a whole thing. So I actually went and got a car, because it's, you know, you get picked up right there at the airport. It's simple.
Right.
It's effortless. You get to relax a little bit instead of trying to figure out that last bit of the journey to your hotel. And boy, it's like, yeah, you're moving on the same streets that I'd be traveling around like the rest of the time I'm there. And you see how slowly you go block to block in a city like London. And then the whole time I'm there, I would actually go, I purposely didn't switch my Maps app from car as the main directions thing. You know, so every time I say I want to get from here to here, it would start with car. And then the next thing I would do is have to tap the little, you know, train button.
Right.
I liked it because it would always say something like 25 minutes. And I would see by car, it would give me like three routes. And then I'd say train button, and it would be 17 minutes. you know, including the walking to the station. And
Right,
it's like,
right.
yeah, because I could see as you're walking around how slowly the cars move through the little narrow streets of London. And it's like, yeah, you don't want a car in London, really. You know, when you could,
Right.
it
Well,
felt
it's
like hyperdrive.
a lot like Manhattan that way. Just
Yeah.
you don't want to drive. You don't want to drive there. You
You don't
just
want to
don't.
drive. It's like hyperdrive. You get on the underground at one stop, and you almost don't even worry about the time to get to the next stop. It's like you're zapped across the city, and then you're there.
Cool.
So yeah, and another thing we talk about a lot when we come back from trips is, you know, power. You know, especially when you go
Yes.
to a country that doesn't use the same power or types of plugs as the United States does, which is certainly true for the UK. And a couple, two interesting things happened on this trip. The first interesting thing is that the last minute, I didn't do that much prep work and packing. I like packed at the last minute and then left. And I have a little you know, box that has my power converters for converting the plug shape. It's not really converting power, it's just the shape of the plugs.
I've got one of those boxes too,
Yeah.
yes.
And I grabbed a stack, it was three UK converters
Right.
basically chunked together. And I just grabbed it and threw it in my suitcase. Because I'm going to the UK, this is what these are for,
Right.
right? And then I got to the hotel, and then I realized I took three of these with. I only actually had one thing to plug in, because what has changed in recent years is now it's very common to have a power adapter that has more than one USB port on the other side.
Right.
Whereas in the past time I had one power adapter for my phone, one for my laptop, you know, and so on. I now had a power adapter that had three USB ports on it. So I
Right.
was like, I bought three plugs and there was only a maximum of one thing I needed to plug in. So I thought it was hilarious that I had packed those. But then I challenged myself when I got into the hotel room and I put that power adapter, all that stuff in my suitcase. And I said, I'm not going to use any of those. Let's see. And sure enough, there were two USB outlets
Right.
on my nightstand.
Yep.
There was a third one that was on the clock radio on my nightstand, which was perfectly positioned for my Apple Watch charger. Like I slipped that thing in there and I was able to hold my Apple Watch on it. And then there was another set of two USB ports over on the little desk area. And that's it. I never had to take, I didn't have to take my power adapter either. So that was kind of interesting. It truly was the case that I never even had to notice that UK used a different voltage and
Yeah,
different plugs.
they have very different plugs. So the laptop,
Yeah.
doesn't that require a higher power USB, something that delivers, 35, 60 watts?
It doesn't require it. It work it'll charge faster. But
So
being
even with
yeah.
the little 2 amp USB 3
Yep.
whatevers,
Yep.
you just let it charge overnight.
Exactly. I you know,
Ah,
especially
so
it's, you know, it's
cool. Yep.
part of the fact, you know, I've got a MacBook Air, so it's got a battery that lasts for, you know, 8 hours of serious work, maybe even
Right.
more, you know, for just browsing. But that's one factor. And another factor is, of course, I'm on vacation. I'm trying to limit the time on my laptop, so I'm
Of
not using
course.
it that much. I didn't actually put in any real legit work sitting there and try to get stuff done, making videos, and do any of that. And then, yeah, I didn't even bother to plug it in most of the time until I'd go to sleep, and then I'd stick it on the desk and plug it in, which would always charge it to 100% overnight. I'm sure it took most of the night to do that,
Sure.
but yeah, it's just never really needed the power adapter. If I had gone over there with the intention of like I'm going to put some days of work in,
Right.
then maybe I would have used my, you know, probably it was just, I don't know, 30 or 35 watt adapter that I brought with me. But
Right.
yeah.
It's funny that I know we've talked about this before. I just love that all of these adapters that we now have, the only thing we care about is the physical size and shape of the plug, because the adapter handles just whatever voltage you happen to throw at it.
Exactly.
That makes some things so much easier. I've appreciated that in my recent trips very much.
Definitely. Definitely. Cool.
So, you've been taking pictures of the moon,
I have not,
but
but I do. But yes, I do want to talk about taking pictures of the moon. So this is interesting. I don't know if you've heard about this, and this isn't anything new for like this month, right? That's just something I stumbled upon. But a couple of years ago, maybe it was like 2 years ago, I got a few questions from people about the iPhone's cameras. that had to do with taking pictures of the moon, because they said, hey, I tried to take a picture of, you know, the moon with my iPhone with this great new camera. I got the Pro model, the 13 Pro, 14 Pro, whatever. And the moon looks like a fuzzy bright dot, right? And which makes sense to me. You're taking it with basically a point and shoot camera. There's no telephoto lens at all. Trying to capture the moon with that is kind of pointless. But the reason people were asking is they would say, but my friend with a Samsung Android phone took amazing pictures of the moon and they showed them to me. And how can I do that on the iPhone? So I would say, okay, I guess put it on a tripod. Maybe were they using another lens? No. Okay. Well, I mean, zoom it as best you can. Have it on a tripod. Change, you know, play with the settings, you know, all of that. Maybe use a separate camera app where you can manually adjust things. And anyway, and I kind of forgot about that. I was like, okay, I don't know. I think there's some sort of trick here. Maybe their Android phone friend was not being straightforward with them about how they got the picture or whatever.
Okay.
But then I read this article that, so apparently the reason people were taking pictures a couple years ago with their Samsung phones is because they introduced a space photography feature and featured heavily in advertisements taking pictures of the moon with their Android phones and how great they came out. And that's why people were actually doing it. It was like, oh, yeah, I can do this with my new phone. Let's try it. Hey, it works. Look at this beautiful picture I took of the moon. Using digital zoom, like 100x digital zoom,
yikes,
zoom in on the moon and somehow end up with a picture of the moon that looks good, that looks really good. And it turns out it's basically fake. It's not fake as in there weren't real pictures. They were real pictures. And it's not fake as people aren't actually getting those results. They were getting those results. But built into the camera app was a lot of, you know, stuff. And the iPhone's got this too, stuff that makes photos look good. Stuff that adjusts light for different parts of the photo in different ways.
Okay.
Stuff that tries to interpret things like, oh, this is a person's face. Let's do the smoothing. As opposed to this is a tree with leaves, let's make it sharper. You know,
right.
Phones do all this stuff now. It's one of the main things that makes pictures on phones good, and Apple certainly does that. They actually featured it in ads too. What these space shots on these phones are doing is that kind of thing, and they're using AI, and they've actually been trained on photos of the moon, so they're not necessarily just seeing that, you've tried to take a picture of the moon. I'm going to pull the moon out of your photo and stick in a photo of the moon.
Right.
It's not exactly that. It's more of, hey, this looks like it's the moon. I know what the moon's supposed to look like. I'm going to kind of adjust the photo right there to add detail that's not possible otherwise. And that's what's happening. So you do get a nice picture of the moon with your camera, but it's really pulling a lot of that data from a learned kind of AI model.
For some reason, I just have this vision of Clippy. It looks like you're trying to take a picture of the moon. Would you like me to give you a picture of the moon?
Exactly. So this article, I'll link to an article, and that article, I think, links to other more technical articles explaining exactly how this works. And it kind of has an interesting thing, you know, a lot of questions there, because there's no doubt you're getting a nice picture of the moon that on your Samsung phone that you're not getting on the iPhone. But is it really your picture of the moon that you're seeing? Yeah, maybe you don't care, in which case, great.
The scenario that it doesn't cover, and I don't know that this would ever happen in our lifetime, but let's say that, you know, there's another random meteorite impact on the moon. So the actual surface of the moon changes.
That,
depending on the training data, that could invalidate most of the training data.
Exactly.
What kind of a picture are you going to get?
Yeah, that's an interesting, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I saw somebody post on social media, you know, after the eclipse, I wish I remembered who it was, that the moon is the most photographed object in human history, right? Simply because we take pictures of things all the time. We take pictures of trees and buildings and mountains, but not specific trees, buildings, and mountains all the time. And we don't take pictures of the sun because most of the time the sun's not going to give us a good picture.
Right.
We take sunset pictures, sure, and sunrise, but that's about it. But the moon ends up in lots of photos because we take pictures of it, but also because we don't, because it's in the sky a lot
Exactly.
for half the day and it gets in our photos. Plus, when there's an eclipse, we take tons of pictures. And in the case of a solar eclipse, we're not even capturing the moon. It's just in our picture, but it is there. It's an object, just very poorly photographed. I mean, during a total solar eclipse, the photo that if you take a photo of totality, you've taken a photo of the sun and moon that, on the one hand, is one of the best pictures you'll ever be able to take of the sun with a regular camera, even though the sun is completely blocked.
Right.
And you're also taking a picture of the moon that has virtually zero information
Right.
about the moon. It's just a blackness, right? So that makes it interesting. It's the best picture you could possibly take of the sun and the best picture you could possibly take of the moon, and also the worst picture you could possibly take of the sun and the worst picture you could possibly take of the moon, all at the same time.
That's impressive.
Yeah, think about it. It's like, here's a great picture of the moon. You can't see the moon. And it's a great picture of the sun.
But you
You
can't
can't
see
see the sun.
the sun.
Anyway.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
So, my weekend. Let's talk about my weekend so far.
Okay.
So, one of the things that has changed in the world of PCs fairly dramatically, I think, is that it used to be kind of a standard recommendation that about once a year or so, you should really reformat and reinstall Windows and reinstall all your apps and so forth. The concept is that, over time, Windows just sort of gathered crust and became a little bit unstable, and apps did the same thing, and a lot of unexplained problems would go away with a completely fresh install. Fortunately, honestly, that's really no longer the case. For the quote unquote average user, Windows remains stable, certainly stable enough throughout the expected lifespan of the computer. Much like hard disks lasting longer than your computer will, when a Windows installation now is, it's very reasonable for you to assume that it will remain that one installation, plus all the updates that happen throughout the life of your computer. I, on the other hand, am not the average consumer. I just do things. This is a Windows 10 machine that's been upgraded to Windows 11. I've installed software. I've uninstalled software. I've reinstalled software. I've added hardware. I've removed hardware. I've done all of the things that contribute to eventual instability. So it's been about 4 years now since I got this machine. And okay, it reached that threshold for me. So, for one thing, that it was 4 years, given the way that I use the machine, to me is actually pretty nifty. It's a pretty good reflection of how things really have improved over the years. The symptoms, why did I decide to do this? Well, it was kind of sort of getting slow in unexpected places, and there was some odd behavior. But the thing that really pushed me over the edge, of course, was that after I think 3.5 years of never seeing a blue screen, I had like about three of them in the course of 2 weeks. And I just took that as a hint,
Yeah, ouch.
a clue that, okay, maybe it's time. So, I did that. I actually did that over the weekend. I backed up the existing system drive just so as not to lose anything. And then I reinstalled Windows 11 from scratch. So it wasn't even an upgrade, it was a complete reinstall of the current version of Windows 11. There's more to the story. And in fact, yes, I'm working on an article about that because, of course, there were stumbling blocks along the way. But the bottom line is that, yeah, Windows came back. It was nifty. It was clean. It took, the actual install from start to finish was maybe an hour at most. And that's even downloading it all from the internet online, in real time. Then I spent the next day and a half reinstalling applications just because. That my approach to this, and actually my recommendation for people who do this, is that you don't just install applications. Install the applications when you need them. So that you only end up with the applications that you actually need, which is, you know, that works for me, except as it turns out, I use a lot of applications. I use a lot of stuff. Everything from having three different browsers to, you know, OBS, the recording software, to, you know, text editors, to this, that, and the other thing. So it took a while. And indeed, as we sit here, I am recording, you know, this Zoom meeting that we're running is using that that rebuilt Windows 11 machine. However, and I think you probably realized that a however was coming.
Yeah.
So one of the issues, like I said, in leading me up to doing this was unexpected slowdowns at weird times. And what I discovered on rebuilding and resetting up my machine is that one specific drive, a 5 terabyte, it's a standard, of course, spinning platter hard drive, but it's internal to the machine, that I keep my OneDrive on, I keep my Dropbox on, I keep a couple of other large things on there. That thing, every time it was being accessed, my system came to a really difficult slowdown. And of course, because of issues with both OneDrive and Dropbox, it was being accessed very, very heavily immediately after the reinstall. So I finally decided that the right thing to do was to push a buy now button over on Amazon. And in fact, I hold in my hands an 8 terabyte Barracuda hard disk that I will be installing into this machine after we finish our recording. One of the reasons I bring it up at all is because this is the second time I have really, really benefited heavily from where I live. And I say that because this decision to do this was made this morning. I just, you know, I thought about it, you know, fell asleep to thinking about it and thought about it overnight and said, you know what? It's just the right thing to do. That 5 terabyte drive, it might be okay. I might, you know, end up refurbishing it and doing something with it later. But this is an opportunity now to upgrade that drive and just do things. So at 9:59 this morning, I pushed the buy now button. Well, actually, it was a add to cart then check out because I also wanted to choose the same day shipping so that it would arrive here today. And I had two options for same day. I could get it between 10 and 3, or I could get it between like 3 and 7. Notice that it was 10 was part of the window when I hit the button at 9:59, right? So they were saying that, okay, it could be here in about a minute, or it could take you 3 hours, but, you know, it's going to be here on the same day. And sure enough, this afternoon, like I said, I'm holding it in my hand. It showed up at about, you know, 2 hours after, 3 hours after I placed the order, which is, I've done this before, only with replacement hard drives, actually. But it's been wonderful every single time to be able to make that kind of a decision and then act on it just as quickly. And in this case, as a Prime member for these particular drives, the same day shipping was not extra. It was just, you know, free Prime shipping same day. You know, they of course try to guilt you into having it arrive on your Prime day, right? Where you try and get as many of your deliveries done on the same day so as to save, I don't know, gas or boxes or whatnot.
Yeah.
But in this case, this was a no, I need it now. And sure enough, it shows up. So a very, very long story. And honestly, it's longer than I've talked about so far, which is why I'll be writing it up as an article. But like I said, after we're done recording this podcast, I will be shutting this machine down and swapping some hard drives and seeing what happens. Hopefully the 5 terabyte drive will last long enough for me to be able to actually copy its entire, you know, everything on it to the replacement drive. And we'll see how that goes. So, to be continued.
Cool. Yeah, no, I definitely have used that. And sometimes I use it, or I don't use it, but I do notice this there. Actually, I ordered something on my return trip from London. I was just bored while waiting for the plane. and I remembered there was something I needed, and I just ordered it on Amazon while waiting to board. And it was actually at my door when I arrived. So it beat me, and I was racing it from London, and it was coming from a warehouse probably in Denver somewhere. But, you know, it was funny that, you know, it was like I ordered this, I don't know, before, on my way home, and it beat me. But, yeah, I'm surprised, though, that I guess I'm not surprised. I live in a downtown area, and so, you know, I've got a lot of things on Amazon that are readily available that could get here fast.
Sure.
Including a lot of items like food or food related items that, because I'm surrounded by Whole Foods.
Yes.
You know, which is Amazon. And I don't know. There's some relationship. I'm sure there's a warehouse around here too, but those Whole Foods locations, I mean, I can return items to those Whole Foods locations, which is rather nice since one's within walking distance.
There's actually a Whole Foods fairly close to us, like, you know, maybe a couple miles. The problem is it's down a direction that we never, ever head. So it's one of those things that we never think to make a detour to go see. Same thing. It's right next to a Trader Joe's, which we also then never see. but yeah, and same thing here. I mean, this is Seattle, right? Amazon headquarters, et cetera. There's plenty of warehouses around, I'm sure. I'm not sure exactly where. And I did notice when it was delivered, it was not in an Amazon truck. It was some guy in his Toyota, right?
Right. And yeah.
It's
sure.
It's a personal car. It's their equivalent of I guess Uber deliveries or Uber Eats kind of deliveries. They just, you know, it's a gig job where they send people out with things.
Yep.
I've also had the experience where when visiting a relative up in Bellingham, we'd be up there for a few days, and early on we decided, oh, son of a gun, we need X. And sure, why not? Order it, have it delivered to the relative. And sometimes it's something them, sometimes it's something for me because I happen to be staying there. But again, very, very convenient to be able to get this stuff that way. Amazon has a lot of issues, don't get me wrong, but man, do they really win in convenience.
Yep, definitely. So the last episode, which I guess was 2 weeks ago, we talked about that humane AI pin, which neither of us have, but we talked about, you know, what
we talk about it anyway.
Say.
Sure.
Yeah, about it anyway. And there, so it turns out, you know, there's another AI specific device that's out. So we should talk about that too, even though neither of us have it. it's called the Rabbit R1. So this is, it's similar to the Humane AI in that it's a very different device. It's like that doesn't really have a parallel to, you know, what's been available before. In this case, it's a small little plastic device with a small screen on it. And it just has basically two input things, a little scroll wheel and a button, a single button. And the screen is a touchscreen, but apparently you don't use the touchscreen for almost anything. And then it's got, I guess, a microphone and a speaker and a camera. And it's, you know, the thing about these devices that makes them similar is that they're definitely experiments in new pieces of hardware. This one, for instance, has a camera, a single camera, but it spins. So it's actually on a little cylinder on the device. And if you use it as a front-facing camera, it spins to face front, and rear-facing, it spins to face rear, which is interesting.
It's an interesting approach, yeah.
It is a very interesting approach. And the scroll wheel itself is kind of an interesting way to do it, especially when you have a touchscreen. And even the button's on the side, and it's kind of a big button that you just press. It's a very interesting experiment. And it's, of course, just like the Humane AI pin, the Rabbit R1 is built around AI. The idea is that it's going to call out to a server, and the server is really going to do all the processing for whatever it is. So you ask it a question, like a factual question about something, and it will send that over the internet and come back to you with an answer, and it will speak it or display it on the screen or both. This has a screen. The Humane AI pin didn't have a screen, but it did a projection thing onto your hand.
Right.
This has an actual real screen, so you could read stuff on it. There's even a terminal mode where you actually can use the touchscreen, and there's a little keyboard, and you can type and ask questions. And so it's a very odd device. And here's the weird thing about the camera. The camera doesn't take pictures. You can't actually, that's not what it's for. What it's for is you point it at something And then you use the AI to be like, what's in this picture? What is this object? What is this plant? What is this animal? That's what the camera's for.
Fascinating.
Or in this one review I saw, you can point it at your computer screen at an email and say, summarize this email for me. And we'll actually look at the email. I guess it's doing, you know, image to text translation.
Right.
Figure out what it is, doing the summary, and then it reads a summary to you. So that's kind of a weird, interesting thing to do. It's very different than the Human AI Pen, which was like $700. This is a $200 device. So right. It's going at the low end. It's basically saying, hey, it's just $200. Give it a try. Why not? What have you got to lose? That kind of thing.
And it's not a pen, right? It's not something you attach to yourself. It's something
like
you would
square.
Throw into a pocket or so. Yeah,
you just drop it in your pocket. It seems like it's made to be more durable. Drop it in your pocket, throw it on the desk. You know, it's like not, you know, not something that's like this delicate, you know, expensive thing you need to take care of. It doesn't do much in it because it looks like the main thing it does is you can ask like AI like questions about stuff, which I think is interesting. And to me, almost when I saw one of the reviews, nobody mentioned this, but to me, it did what a lot of these devices do is you always have to do the comparison to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right? Which is a comparison you can go all the way back to the earliest phones for, right? And this felt like, hey, this is a pretty close thing because it doesn't do a lot of stuff, you know, beyond this, but you could just ask it questions about stuff and then ask it follow-up questions and then just continue to talk and learn about things, right? It does that. It does it over Wi-Fi, but there is a SIM card slot, so you can get a plan with somebody and
interesting,
you know, hook it up. But I think it's, you know, that whole idea is $200, just use it over Wi-Fi and play around with it. It has apps, but at launch, it has exactly 4 apps. It's like Uber, it's like DoorDash, maybe Spotify, and I can't even remember what the fourth one is. It's really basic apps. Mm-hmm. So you can't even like you want to use Apple Music? No, it's used to Spotify. You can ask Spotify to play music. You want to get a Lyft? No, sorry, just use Uber. So it just has these 4 apps. But then here's where it gets interesting is it talks about it's supposed to use something instead of a large language model. They talk about a like large action model. The idea is the AI is supposed to be able to interface with apps. Presumably, I think it's talking most of the time about web-based apps.
Right.
Interface with them in the way that you talk to, say, ChatGPT. So ChatGPT, you can describe what you want. It can give you checks back. With the action model, you should be able to talk, and it should, instead of giving you text back, it actually uses like an app and does what you want. So technically, if, say, there was a website where you could, you know, order food from, but it's never heard of it or whatever. It could actually look at data of people ordering food from this website, figure out what's going on, and then you'd say, order me a pizza from this website or using this app. And it's like, okay, I have all this data of people using this site to order food. This person wants a pizza. I'll figure it out. Just like ChatGPT figures out like the text response, this figures out the actions. And so they train it not on language, but on apps. And according to the company, they've trained it on those 4 that you've got, you know, that come with it.
Mm-hmm.
But they've actually trained it on hundreds more and that they're in the testing phase for. So they'll be releasing more apps saying you could use it with this website and that website and all of that. And they also claim that you'll be able to train it on your own more unique, rarely used apps. So you'll be able to actually use the camera in it and point it at the screen where you're doing something on, you know, on a web app and show it, hey, this is me filing a bug report in my company's bug report system.
Mm-hmm.
And then show it you doing that and maybe do it a few times and then go and say, okay, now file this bug report for me. And it'll just do it. That's the vision. Anyway,
interesting,
which is kind of an interesting thing. And I guess what they're saying here is like, we finished the hardware. Here's the hardware. Now you can get it and you can actually like see it as it evolves. You know, you'll get new things as they come out. So it's kind of interesting. And, you know, one of the things reviewers kept saying, So it's basically a piece of hardware, and almost all features are yet to come, right? Buy it now. It doesn't do anything, but features yet to come, which actually they said, well, that's ridiculous. Like, that's not how things should be done. But it occurred to me that set-top TV boxes and actually smart TVs were kind of sold that way at the beginning.
Sure.
You know, you bought the smart TV and you're like, great, what can I do with smart TV? Well, it turns out not much, because it's, you know, 2017 or something. And then eventually you actually were able to do, you know, like if you buy, I actually have a 2018, 2019 smart TV that I instantly just, you know, here's the video input. And I'm just going to use, you know, my that time it was like a DirecTV box. That's how I watch TV with it.
Right.
And I have still have that same TV. All the apps on it now make it possible to not have any, I don't do any of that. Like, I just watch Netflix and Peacock and,
yep,
and Paramount Plus on it. And it's like, so the functionality they built into it didn't let me watch TV when I bought it, but now it completely lets me watch TV.
Yep.
And maybe that's what they're going for with this. It's like, it doesn't let you do anything, and it's certainly not a replacement for your phone now, but maybe 3 years from now, it will be.
So here's my concern about the device. So it's $199. They claim no subscription. And that could be important in the long run, because what I think this device is essentially a thin client, physically and literally, software-wise. It sounds like to do anything at all, it is basically communicating back to its headquarters, its mothership, so that all of these features that can get added in the future aren't necessarily software updates on the device itself, but rather increased capability that they enable on the back-end servers, which is fine. I think that's a fine model. I mean, it does mean that you are limited to having reasonable Wi-Fi connectivity, depending on you know, what kind of protocol and how resilient they're making it. But this concept of no subscription makes me wonder about long-term viability, because it implies you're going to be using their services for life, right? For the life of this device. $200 up front forever doesn't seem like something that's truly sustainable in terms of a business. So, well, it'd be interesting to see where this goes, but I really do think that most of what they're talking about doing isn't on the device at all, but rather to the services that it connects to.
Yep. Yeah. It's definitely, it is interesting. I think beyond just what this device does and what the Humane device does, it's interesting that we're seeing new configurations of hardware all of a sudden.
Yes.
Which makes me wonder if there's something else going on in terms of the way the chain of development, you know, works in terms of like designing a device, having, you know, an engineering team to actually say, oh, that's a nice design you have. Now we have to figure out how to actually make it a device, and then getting a manufacturer to put it together and then getting it distributed. Like, this whole chain of things takes, you know, in the past took companies like, you know, the phone companies like Nokia and Ericsson in the past, and companies like Dell and Apple and all with computers and all. And then even up to a few years ago, still took big companies to kind of, you know, like Samsung's and Apple and, you know, to be able to put those together. And now it seems like it's maybe easier. Like, maybe it's just, maybe it's been getting easier all along, and now it's finally at the point where smaller companies can much more easily design interesting devices. So instead of the future being, oh, we all just get a standard phone, like it's a touchscreen phone and it's standard. I mean, the iPhone and Android phones are pretty close in terms of devices, right?
Right.
They've got almost the same feature set.
Sure.
You know, you can argue as much as you want about little specifics, but they're basically the same device, a touchscreen device with a couple buttons, the camera, Wi-Fi, cellular, all that. And then you just have software that changes. And now we're seeing, no, there may be specialized devices. Our future may not be everybody has one device and that one device can run different software, but maybe we have a wide variety of things. There's a company called Teenage Engineering that, you know, they make devices, and I've got one mostly having to do with music, and they're bizarre little devices. I've got this one little, it's just a sequencer, and it looks like a pocket calculator. And It's a pocket calculator with no case, by the way, just like an open board with some buttons on it. But it's a really pretty full-featured little sequencer that you could do and create, like, you know, music on. And they have a variety of them. And they've got some other devices. They're all unique. They're all really interesting little hardware designs that don't look like anything else. And they're standalone. They're not like a peripheral. They're not like a keyboard or something. They're actually like full devices. They do everything, you know, that is meant to be done with it. And that's a small company too. So I'm wondering if, yeah, we're going to see, like, this is the beginning of, you know, this time next year or the year after, tons of interesting little devices with different configurations and functionalities. And
I wonder, just as kind of another tangent, how much of this increase in essentially production speed, development speed, has been enabled by 3D printing.
Yeah.
With these hardware devices. Because it used to be creating a physical mock-up of whatever it is you were working on required time. I mean, lots of different skills, lots of different ways to do it, but more than anything, it required time. Now you can design something in your machine, you know, in your computer, and, you know, have it printed probably overnight. I don't know how fast these things are these days. But that same wireframe that you throw together on your machine then ends up being the basis for the final production work as well. I just wonder sure. if there's a
yeah, because I mean you could be, as the developer, the engineer, you know, printing on a 3D printer.
Yep.
And then you could, when it's done and you've got it perfect, then you can send that to the engineering department of a factory in China, and they're not going to be using that slow printer you're using.
Exactly. So
they're going to use that same file to basically say, okay, we need to mass produce. Here's the case. Here's these various parts. And then all these other parts come off the shelves. I'm pretty sure that that both the Humane AI Pin and the Rabbit R1 are not using any unique parts, right? They're using off-the-shelf processors and memory and
probably even the OS is, you know, like based on Linux or something.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's getting easier and it's more interesting. And there's definitely an attractiveness, I find. I mean, we're both gadget guys, and probably most people listening to this would be as well. So whenever I see like a cool gadget, there's something attractive about it. And, you know, I just for both the Humane AI Pin and the Rabbit R1, like I want to see them in person. If somebody told me, oh, they have them for sale at the shop downtown, I'd be like, I'm on my way. I just want to see it. You know, I want to hold it. And, you know, I feel the same way about digital cameras. You know, I can't walk into a store that's got lots of digital cameras without like gravitating to them, even though I'm fine with digital cameras, but I want to see the latest, you know, Panasonic and the Fuji and all that. And they've got different designs, and the way they're doing buttons and screens is different and everything. So anyway.
Sounds interesting. By the way, I did go take a look at Teenage Engineering, and their devices look very cool. Yeah. There was one that caught my eye as you were talking about devices that just, you know, catch our interest. There's a voice recorder, which is something that I've been struggling with for years, literally. And said, oh, this looks cool. Look at all those features. Look at all that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's $1,500. No, thanks. This is not the voice recorder.
Yeah, because it's they make most of their stuff is kind of pro level.
Exactly. Like it's pro equipment, clearly. Yeah. But it's just, it's funny.
I do. So. The one I have, I think I got on sale for like $60. And it's just the little sequencer that's bass. So it's just bass sounds, and you could set it up, and it was reminiscent of early electronics that made music.
Right.
And the idea is I could actually get the bass one, and I can get other ones. There's a whole bunch of them, and I could actually put them together, and I could use them to compose music, and they would all be in sequence. Or I could just have the bass one, and a friend of mine could get, you know, the one that's, you know, the piano sound or whatever, and we could actually jam with them, sequence them together. It's really interesting stuff. I mean, it's like, but you know, yeah, it's definitely, it's not cheap, but it's so cool looking.
It is very much. Speaking of cool.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Ain't It Cool. So mine isn't necessarily a specific thing. It's more of an interesting process I decided to go through last week. I finished, you know, two or three things on my reading list, and I was kind of thinking about what do I want to read next. And it dawned on me that I have I want to say 2 or 3 years worth of all of the books that I've read listed over on 7takeaways.com. Because a part of 7 takeaways at the bottom, it just shows what I'm currently reading, and then I keep that list up to date as I accumulate things. So I copied that list to the clipboard. I went over to ChatGPT, and I said, please recommend for me 5 books that would likely interest me based on this list of books I've already read. And it came up with a list. The reason that that this process kind of got my attention is it accurately listed 2 books that I've already read that were not on the list. So, for example, its first recommendation was The 3-Body Problem, which I read several years ago. My list of books is both fiction and nonfiction. Right. Okay. It's a combination of sci-fi, fantasy. There's self-improvement, just all sorts of random stuff. So the other one that it recommended, I'd actually read some time ago, is Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear by Elizabeth Gilbert. Again, something that I had already read. I said, OK, you got 2 out of 5. That's way better than I was expecting. I was expecting 5 things that I'd never heard of before. So that gave me a little bit of confidence that maybe this recommendation was going to be worth it. So I picked the number 2 book, Hyperion by Dan Simmons. Okay. And I purchased that and am probably about, 5 or 10% way into the book. It's interesting so far. I like it. We'll see if it actually meets my criteria of, yes, I'm really glad I spent the time to read it, but I just thought it was an interesting approach to getting recommendations, based on what I've read so far. What do you think? And it seems to think pretty good.
I got to try that with my Audible, see if I can export my Audible list somehow.
Sure.
All the books
if you just go to audible.com, at a minimum, you can,
I could see them.
You could copy paste the code and yank it out.
Probably, yeah. The interesting thing is, of course, that Audible's been recommending Hyperion to me for a long time. maybe it's a sign that's got to be
it's a small world.
Yeah.
It's weird, though, because out of the thousands and thousands and thousands of books that are available to us, even in a single genre, it is kind of weird that, like I said, it recommended 2 books that I'd already read, and it's recommended now a book that somebody else has been recommending to you. So, yes, it's a sign.
My technique a lot of times is simply to look at, in your 7 takeaways, what you're reading.
Sure.
And then if it looks interesting, I add that to my Audible wish list. Uh-huh. And since you read faster than me, that means that I think so. It seems like you do. So I gather things that you've read. Or maybe it's not. Maybe it's just because I'm also getting other recommendations from other sources and just finding things of my own. So, yeah, probably my Audible wish list, which is several pages long at this point, I'm sure, has a few items on there that originally appeared in your 7 takeaways newsletter. That I said, that looks interesting, and I add it to my wish list, and it's theirs, and I'll eventually get around to them.
Sure. So, that's funny. Yeah. Anyway, that's my Ain't It Cool, just the process.
Yeah, and I think your Ain't It Cool for our last episode was Fallout TV show, and that's pretty much all I've consumed in the last 2 weeks. Fortunately, I was able to download that because Amazon lets you download stuff.
Right.
So I was able to download that on my Mac. So I was able to watch it on my nice big Mac screen on the airplane.
Oh, cool.
So I was able to binge that on the flights. So that's pretty cool. I always love the post-apocalyptic. I like post-apocalyptic or end of the world science fiction, especially if it's weird and especially if it has humor. So Fallout really ticks all those boxes, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No kidding. It's definitely a different model. Like I said last time, I've ever played the game. And it ticks all those boxes. It's fun. It's interesting. It's something we haven't seen before. So, yeah, looking forward to season 2. And yeah, I think I told you last week that it was, or 2 weeks ago, that basically they have me at Walton Goggins because he's just such a great actor in so many different roles that it just made a whole lot of sense.
Yep. Yep. Indeed.
So, and what's funny, I ran across a headline, today or yesterday, that said they had, I don't know if it's an all-time high, but they actually saw a spike, a huge spike in the number of people playing Fallout as a result of the show, which I thought was kind of funny.
Yeah. Cool.
See, self-promotion. So you and I probably run into this all the time. And this is simply that people will ask us questions and they'll use the wrong words, right? Mm. They don't know what the right word for something is. And I get that. That's honestly, I think that's probably, you know, a third of the value that I provide is just being able to understand what it is people are asking and then turn that into the right terminology that would get them the answer they're looking for. But that's not to say that understanding the correct terminology doesn't have value for you. It really does. I'm not... This is going to sound horrible, but not everybody is as forgiving as I am about terminology, right? Yeah. Where there are places where if you go in and say, use the wrong term for something, especially if it's something simple, then, they're going to think, you know, you're an idiot or you just don't know what you're talking about, or it's not worth spending their time with to try and educate you. So it's worth investing a little bit of time in understanding the terminology around technology. And that is, in fact, the article. It's called Terminology Matters. It's askleo.com/20821. The bottom line here is that don't feel bad for not knowing what something means. If it turns out to be useful to you, though, take the time to learn what it should have been or what the right word would have been, so that you'll be able to better communicate and stand a better chance of getting the answers or whatever else it might be that you're needing from the person you're trying to talk to.
Yeah, I definitely need to do a video on that, because, yeah, that's a problem. Especially there's in the Mac world, there's a lot of people that have switched from Windows to Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And the Windows terminology has been in their brains for decades.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The most common one I get that is the most confusing is somebody will use the word or the term taskbar.
I knew it.
and the reason it's the most confusing is because it doesn't directly map on the Mac to one thing. And it can mean the dock right at the bottom of the screen.
Right.
Or the menu bar at the top of the screen.
Right.
And it, for, you know, whatever reason, when somebody moves from Windows to Mac, I guess their brain maps it to one of those two. And to them, that's the taskbar. I'm going up to the taskbar, down to the taskbar, as the case may be. And it makes perfect sense. And it's fine. Sure. You know, it works for them. But then when they ask me a question about the taskbar, it leaves me very confused because I'm like, boy, I'd have different answers depending upon whether you think the taskbar is the menu bar at the top or the dock at the bottom. And I always have to, you know, ask, like, what do you mean by the taskbar?
There's at least one iteration for clarification.
Yeah. Dock at the bottom, menu bar at the top. You know, give me more details here. So anyway, I should probably up. I think I've done a video a long time ago on that, but I should definitely do something more recent.
I don't know how often you run into it, but one of the things that actually prompted the original version of this article some time ago is I continually get people mistaking disk space for RAM. They call them both memory. So.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They call them memory, and it's like, do you really mean memory or do you mean storage? Because they'll say, I bought a Mac that's got 1 terabyte of memory. I'm like, no, you didn't. You didn't. And I think you mean storage, or the opposite. They'll say, I bought a Mac, it's got 8 gigs of memory or 8 gigs of storage. I'm like, no, again, you didn't.
Maybe you got a very, very old Mac. You never know.
And it's tough because it's worse, I think, on phones and tablets too.
Yes.
People confuse those two things all the time.
Sure.
Yeah, I should do a video on updating this. For mine, I'll just point to, I did one on 10 simple ways to improve a photo in the Mac Photos app, because a lot of times people take photos, they put them on their computer, and there's all these great tools, whether you're using, Adobe Lightroom or some other tool, or in most for most Mac users, the Photos app, all these great tools for making the photo look better or look more like you originally saw with your own eyes. But people sometimes are overwhelmed. It's like a whole list of adjustments that you can
sure.
make.
Yep.
It's like, well, here's, you don't have to learn how to use all of that to, you know, actually improve your photos. There's a couple things you can just click this button. You can make adjust this one slider and make an improvement. And it's just a starting point. You know, once you get used to that, maybe if you want, if you like it, you could go further, but at least here's a place to start.
Cool. That reminds me, it's a topic to be discussed in the future. One of the things I did with my machine rebuild is I disconnected from the Adobe ecosystem. I no longer have Photoshop or any of those. I've got alternatives. There were a few things that I was doing with Photoshop, so I found alternatives to each of them, and I said, fine, I don't have to pay the monthly Adobe tax anymore.
Yeah, I'm going to have to wait on that for many years because a lot of my apps that are in the App Store were developed using Adobe Air and Adobe Animate. So if I want to update those apps, which I haven't in years,
right?
Because they're my older apps, but I do want to update them, even if it's just to comply with some sort of new regulation.
Right. Yeah.
I need to be able to open them up in those apps, which means I need to have these licenses. So I'm spending all this money every year.
Just in case.
To keep it up. And I use it for other things. Like, for instance, clip art. You know, a lot of the artwork I use for various things comes as Illustrator files. And there are alternatives for opening Illustrator files.
Mm-hmm.
They're still not to the point where they work well. Because I will actually go and grab some piece of artwork and say, great, I just want to grab this one part of it. And I'll try it in different apps that will open Illustrator files. And it's like, oh, struggling to get that piece, and it's converted it, and it's done all this stuff. And it's like, oh, if I just open an Illustrator, this will take me 1 minute.
It would just work, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All righty. Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up for another week.
Yeah.
As always, thank you for listening, and we will see you here again real soon. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH219. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.